Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and I'm doing a podcast today on two movies. It's called Double Feature, and with me is Michael Kester.
That's right.
Streamlined all that information right at the top. It was good information. Now we can meander for how many minutes? 24, 48, 49?
Well, it depends on how many movies you're talking about. Depends on how much you want to talk before the thing starts. I mean, we have like there's a rundown. You know, we have our top of the show rundown.
I'm here on the rundown with Michael Kester. Going to give me all the information I need.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say we got this show. It's double feature, so there's two movies. So halfway through, we're going to talk about the second movie. So the first piece of information I need is what are the two movies and what is the order of the two movies?
I feel like in the interest of doo-wop rules, we have to do it in the counterintuitive way, but I think that's fair.
Damn. I also thought, one, that it is counterintuitive, and two, I looked at the article. That is, yeah. We keep talking about these doo-wop rules, and every time we do this, everybody tweets at us and goes, no one knows what the fuck you guys are talking about. So I think quite simply, the doo-wop rules state that it sounds like a doo-wop band if it's like a dude and his somethings, you know?
So this is one of the best ones in the history of Double Feature, because today on Double Feature, we have Charlie Varick and the Nice Guys.
I mean, how much? That's got to literally be a doo-wop band, right? I've conceded that we might not even be talking about the right genre of music. I don't listen to doo-wop. Is it doo-wop that does names
it
like
was.
This?
There aren't doo-wop bands now.
Okay, so I've learned something already on Double Feature. There are no doo-wop bands.
Yeah, they're extinct.
Don't send me your fucking SoundCloud. There's no doo-wop bands. We already learned
there are
learned
definitely
it.
No doo-wop bands on SoundCloud.
I don't know about this. All right, send your doo-wop SoundClouds to at playing Michael. Just send links. I want everybody to spam Michael with links to their favorite doo-wop band on SoundCloud. Yeah, it's great because it's the dude's name and it's also the Nice Guys. They're the ones backing him up.
Right.
It does feel, for some weird double feature pairing rule, like the Nice Guys should go first. I don't really know why that is.
No, it's okay. We'll do it the other way. We'll hit the front man for the first 24-ish minutes. And then we'll take a look at the guys behind the front man, the Nice Guys. We'll talk to them. Talk to them after the break.
I never thought about the Nice Guys as a midnight movie, but that puts it in kind of a new light. That's exciting.
Yeah.
There's a reason that the order is so important, and that's because there's going to be spoilers in the show. I have found, this is going to be interesting to you, I found myself fluctuating on spoilers a little bit lately.
Ooh.
I have not, as I've slowly come to accept that I don't have enough time to see every movie ever, I've been a little interested in getting a tiny spoiler here or there. I have to admit it here on the show.
Yeah.
I know what happens in both these movies, so you can't spoil me. But if you could, I might make the independent decision on my own that, hey, spoil the Nice Guys. Fuck it.
Sure.
I'll still see the Nice Guys. I love that Ryan Gosling. It's fine.
Yeah.
Fighting around the world, making that joke. So put that reference high up in the show.
Hey, girl, we're fighting around the world.
There you go. That's a little old school Russell Crowe South Park on there. It's all the Russell Crowe, John Oliver jokes these days. So nobody's talking about the South Parks anymore.
If you're one of those people who can't get enough of our dated South Park references and references to memes that are no longer relevant, well, have we got a Patreon for you?
Oh, yes, this is true. So listen, there's spoilers. Skip if you don't want to be spoiled. But if you just are dying for information and old things, if you're like, Eric, I'm dying for old things, I'll show you where you can get some. On our Patreon, we have a back catalog of all the shows we've ever done, including some Shane Black shows, including some Shane Black shows that we didn't know were Shane Black shows at the time, which is going to be a little interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go back and kind of hang out with us as we watch those movies for the first time. by looking through the entire back catalog of Double Feature while simultaneously supporting the show, which we need, please. So that's at patreon.com/doublefeature. I want to, if people are still listening and haven't just skipped through my rambling Patreon, I want to clue them in on a thing that I think is happening.
Oh, shit.
I think it's about time for all the episodes to disappear. What do you think about that?
Yeah. All of them, like including this one?
Yeah, the whole show, our lives. I think it's time to open a black hole. I just feel like the Double Feature cinematic universe is coming to a close after 10 long years.
And so with a snap of your fingers, you're going to eliminate all of the shows?
Well, it's no secret that we've come on here, and I try not to make a big deal about it until it happens, but increasingly that just means once every 4 weeks.
3 weeks, yep.
But we are barely skirting by on funding the show every month, and you guys have been awesome, and keeping us really anywhere near the number is great. Everybody who's given, that's great. And for the people who have... you don't usually give to stuff and you decided to chuck in just because it's Double Feature and we're so much poorer than your average podcast. You guys are my best friends. That's instant friendship right there. People who give to Double Feature. Go on the patreon.com/doublefeature. We can write each other like teenage romantics. We'll talk on the phone, kick our feet up in the air, hide from our parents, you know, all that cool stuff. Just had a heavy wave of nostalgia watch over there. I don't know what the fuck happened. My point is, since we're not pulling in enough money to do any big, crazy, superfluous thing, we're just barely scrounging enough every other month to keep the show going, really can't afford to keep all these episodes on the feed. And so we've put this off for a long time, but I think, and we're coming up on a year 11. I'm going to make the assumption that the Patreons will pull through for us and we're going to make it to year 11. And I think that means we have to take all of the 10 years of the show out of the feed, put it in the archive. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, whatever.
Okay. One of us has given this a little more thought than the other. And I'm now seeing why that is.
I'm going to listen to the same amount of old shows either way. So...
You know, you're not setting a good example here for listeners. The listeners cannot relate to you when you go...
Listen, I direct people, including people in my actual social life, back to old shows because one, I believe in this podcast, and two, it's easier than having conversations with people that I've already had better.
Go listen to my podcast.
Yeah, it's like, well, actually, I was just talking about that 2 weeks ago on my podcast, doublefeature.fm. Go and check that out because I don't feel like having that conversation again.
Michael's just his own walking hype man. You must be insufferable in real life. Just walking around like, well, if you've listened to episode 495, if you go back to the Puppet Master episode, that sure. is Killapalooza.
No, it's always just the Congress. It is infinitely the Congress every time.
You're right. You carry that around like on a handheld like message device and just run up to people and play
I'll talk
Congress.
To you in 24 minutes.
I just feel like, you know, after 10 years, it's a good arbitrary time to chuck those episodes in the backlog, and they just get weightier and weightier. So I'm giving everybody a heads up on this now because people who get in at this Patreon level, we might have to raise the amount of money that it takes to access that backlog. If you're hearing this now and you get on the Patreon now, you'll be grandfathered into all that. So big thanks to you guys and enjoy keeping all that content and check out the other stuff that's on there. Long-winded rant. Sorry about that. I just felt like give people the heads up.
Another thing you get to do if you're part of the Patreon, in addition to listen to all three Terminator Prophecy episodes, is you get to pick movies like Ross did for Charlie Varick, which is the film we are starting now.
I like that this movie is not about beavers. Let me say that.
Ross didn't pick beavers. John picked beavers.
I know. Oh, well, okay. That's why.
I see what you're saying.
I was making a jab at another fucking listener. Okay. Is that okay? I just feel the need to poke and prod all listeners
on
the show.
I hear you. Feel you. This is probably, we actually, okay, so off the air, we had a really funny conversation wherein you were like, what do you want to talk about with Charlie Varick? And I was like, I don't know. And as a joke, because I take nothing seriously, certainly through text message, I was like, I don't know, best car/plane chase scene in film history, at which point you sent me an image from Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, which is a helicopter chase scene. Fuck you.
Yeah, but I thought you'd just go with me. No. I thought you would indulge me because I'm an idiot. I was like, Michael's a good friend. He'll indulge this joke about a movie we watched together 10 years. No, not at all. You pointed out that it's a helicopter, you fuck. I even found the image and sent it to you.
I know, you did a really good job.
I didn't even say it.
You did a really good job.
Whatever. It's all wasted on you.
But I think, I mean,
and neither one of us made a North by Northwest joke.
That's fair. We should have liked to point that out. So this is an actually, this film actually has a really interesting Ryan Gosling reference for me, because I don't know how well you remember a film called Drive.
Yes, I absolutely remember and cherish Drive.
So there's this film called Drive that actually borrows sort of the same plot as this film, which resonated for me because I remember seeing it in Drive and being like, ooh, that's an interesting way to turn up the heat really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it does that thing where they go, we're just small-time criminals robbing a bank. Oh shit, wrong bank. Now we're big-time criminals.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it also, you know, ups the ante by killing off a lady, and then suddenly it feels justified to be a big time criminal. It's the device that this film employs that I think is really interesting is that it opens on a group of people that you don't want to watch in a whole movie and then puts them in a movie you want to watch. Because I just go, I'm not really interested in watching some small time crooks rob a bank. I was like, I am, however, interested in some small time crooks rip off big time crooks and lose somebody in the process.
Well, they become like a weird Robin Hood kind of thing in the process of doing that.
And you start immediately having to grapple with the idea of like, well, if they, you know, if they robbed the bad guys, were they the bad guys ever? Where's the morality lie? And, you know, they didn't know they were ripping off the mob, but had they known and done it anyway, they'd be the good guys, right?
Well, this is something you usually see in the opposite, where somebody starts with good intentions, but realizes maybe they did a bad thing. That's a pretty clear arc. Because then it's about redemption. It's about, okay, well, can I be in denial for a while about this? Then, okay, I'm not in denial. I need to right my accidental wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But this movie does a big wrong straight away and goes, I don't know if I'd go as far as to say it's an accidental right, although it does start to feel like it by the end.
Mm-hmm.
By the end, you're like, well, fuck all these other murderous bastards.
Yeah, exactly.
Look at this poor crop duster just wants to like have a little extra money. And you have to sort of remind yourself that, oh yeah, that was based on an immoral act at the beginning. I think that says something about the power of telling a story, in that over time, as you go through the sort of trials and tribulations with the characters, you start to empathize for people that on the onset are bad people.
Sure. Well, I think that it's actually more telling of the human psychology to just, I mean, to me, it feels a little bit like Stockholm Syndrome, because the longer the camera's pointed at Charlie Varick, the more you're inclined to believe he's the good guy.
Yeah, yeah.
When in reality, that's a false dichotomy. Everybody in the movie can be the bad guy.
Sure.
That's just a thing. But through the magic of Hollywood, bad guys can be good guys too. It's just you spend so much time with this guy that you start dissecting his motivations in a way that's digestible and makes sense. And it's interesting too, because both of these movies kind of do that. Both of these movies have, I mean, outwardly, they're the kind of people, right? So as characters, they're anti-heroes or maybe unlikely protagonists. But as humans, like if you met any of the characters the singer or the band from today's show, if you met them on the street, you would walk away thinking they were a fucking dick.
Well, yeah, I suppose on your general disposition towards humanity, but yeah, sure. Yeah, well, this is, you know, we were talking on the last show a little bit about this, but I think to distill that Hollywood magic down to the thing that I can point at the most, it's simply conflict. as human beings, when you watch other people go through conflict, you identify with that. And it's the easiest way to abstract something. It's how you humanize someone in a situation that's, you know, that's loaded in another way. If you can watch them struggle, watching people struggle makes us want those people to persevere.
Mm-hmm.
This was something we knew early on in the show when our show had much more of a skeptic bent. And I think our lives, we were just both, I don't know where you sat on that now. I haven't, you know, really ever been as deeply thinking about that as I was the first couple of years of the show, of just constantly thinking about how we know what's true in the world, how we pull apart the things that aren't true. And in figuring out something like cold reading or talking to the dead or whatever, one of the pieces that makes that work, or let's say, you know, witchy nonsense in LA. That's, I guess I do still think about it today. I just dismiss it out of hand more easily and then run off and go back to whatever I was worrying about. But one of the things that makes all of these kind of cons work is that we seem to have, I don't know, I don't have the psychological background to really say this for sure, but we do seem to have an internal urge to help people along as they're struggling with something, right? So to, let's say, to brush away a socially awkward, a cold reader is speaking to one of your dead relatives. Begins with a J. It's like a J, like a, and you want to say a name.
Sure.
You want to say a name of one. You just have this internal impulse. Mm-hmm. You can't explain it.
Mm-hmm.
And you might even think that cold reader is a fucking charlatan.
Mm-hmm.
You might not believe this at all, but you still want to go, it's John.
Jerome. That's my grandfather's name. Yeah, good job.
I was going to say John because of beavers. I was going to say Beaver John is dead to me on this episode. Love you, John. Always love John. There's a couple of Johns that listen to our show and are on the Patreon. Love you guys. And Ross, I guess, too. In fact, let me name everyone who's ever given to our Patreon. Sorry, I don't know where this went. But yeah, you have this natural urge internally to help someone along as they're struggling in conversation, to brush away that awkward, to make the social transition more smooth.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that is linked in some way to how we watch conflict in cinema, that we watch people struggle with something and we are so compelled by that. It's why we base all of storytelling around conflict.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in any story? Tell me any story. And it's this person has to do this thing and here's what's in their way. It's why we frame things in terms of heroes and villains.
Mm-hmm.
Because what is the villain? They're the thing stopping the hero from getting the thing they want.
Right.
It's why we have whatever devices. Mm-hmm. Or not whatever devices, but Maltese Falcons. What did we fucking call those?
Oh, fuck. I mean, I know what they're really called.
Yeah, there was a, there are golden briefcases,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
There's something in a movie that the hero has to get. And so we know who our hero is. We know there's a thing they have to get, and we know who the villain is. Of those three items, I feel like the definition that you need is you need to know your hero. You need to know, actually, I might say you need to know your villain more than anything. Then you need to know your hero, and then you need to know the item.
Mm-hmm.
So in our Maltese Falcon situation, we don't really need to know the item. That's why we talk about these things. That's why the golden briefcase, because the item that they're chasing doesn't really matter. The chase matters,
mm-hmm.
right? And the obstacle matters because the obstacle allows them to have that conflict. Who the person even is doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. If a TV show you've never seen before opens on a person running to do a thing and then falling and struggling to get out of a, I don't know, a well. Sorry, I'm just like off the cuff story
really building. Bad TV show. You know, a TV show opens, you've never seen it, a guy's running, falls in a well, can't get a thing.
I was like, oh no, what happens then? I'm not really sure. But you know, you're immediately compelled when you see something like this, which is why my storyteller can be so lazy, because you're just like, where are they running? Why is there a conflict? Oh why no, a well, you don't well? Know what the fuck this is. It's why as a story, it sounds so terrible, but you'd sit there and watch that and be like, I'll see where this is going. Because you go, oh, conflict. So I think conflict is what, when we just say something vague, like through the power of Hollywood cinema, heroes can become, or villains can become heroes, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
That really speaks specifically to conflict. It doesn't matter at the beginning of the movie that they stole money and stealing money is bad. We root for them because a little bit, just a tiny amount of time elapses and then a terrible thing happens. They get our sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just see trials and tribulations.
Mm-hmm.
And when they one up somebody, we cheer. And so it doesn't matter, you know, if those people are mobsters or if they turn out to be the police they're running from or whatever, we see them struggling. And as humans, we go, oh, I know what struggle's like.
Sure.
It really sucks.
Right.
And when I'm struggling, I want to succeed. And therefore, Charlie, I want you to succeed.
Well, and as somebody who's watched over 1,000 films just for this podcast, I also know a hamster style when I see it. And I know that plane's going to flip over before it even gets in the fucking plane.
You saw the plane flip?
Yeah.
You saw that coming?
Oh, yeah.
I thought the plane flip was like super abrupt. I was just like, wow, that just...
You didn't...
I mean, I knew when the plane flipped that there was a clever con at work here.
Well, I mean, so did I, but the plane flip was, it just felt way too much. Like, if the plane never flipped over, it would have felt like Gremlins, where, he was just like, yeah, when I was young, I used to flip airplanes until one day I found my father dead in the chimney. After a particularly hard plane flip.
All right. I thought maybe you just assumed every time someone got in an airplane, it's about to do a flip.
No. He mentions that like her shtick was X and or whatever her thing was. I don't remember what her deal was, but his was that he was drunk and would flip an airplane. And it's amazing because when he said that, I was sitting there staring at the screen going, the fuck do you mean flip an airplane? and then in that final sort of chase scene, that the field climax of the airplane versus car moment, I'm sitting there shouting at the screen, he's going to flip the plane, still not knowing what to expect, but at least knowing I'm about to know what it means to flip a plane. And then the plane flips over and I was like, I guess, yeah, that's what that is.
Man, there's no amount of filmmaking or breaking down scenes or being analytical that stops a plane flipping over from being impressive.
Yeah.
It's just, I can look at that and be like, okay, well, what did they actually have to do to accomplish this? And really, you know, you could get away with flipping a plane, having no money and not even a plane. There's just so many ways to shoot that and just have the audience go along and be like, okay, the plane flipped. There we go. But seeing it is still like, holy fuck, they flipped a plane. It's as impressive thinking about it happening in real life as it is seeing it happen in the movie. Those are always some of my, I remember once talking about James Bond movies on the show. We were talking about one of those Jaws. It was in the sequel that has Jaws.
Mm-hmm. Moonraker.
Thank you. Yeah, and they were fighting in midair on a cable car.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just so fucking floored by that. There are just certain amounts of spectacle cinema that, especially when they have some practical element to them, you know, in these bigger CG spectacles, I get lost in that stuff. But when I see a physical plane and it flips, it might as well have happened right outside my house.
Yeah.
I'm just like, everybody come see this plane flip. This is insane. Anyways, we should talk about
the band.
The backup dancers.
Got to get to the band.
Is the nice guys ever the backup dancers? That's the band in doo-wop, right?
Yeah,
that's
it could be the Supremes, but they sing too. They're more than just a pretty face.
That's good. It's good to know.
This movie is I don't think Shane Black has said this, but it doesn't matter because it's 100% a fact.
oh no.
This movie is a spiritual prequel to Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
There it is. There it is.
I don't think that there is.
Okay, so really quick, here's, let's call this a mini spoiler if you don't like a plot synopsis. I was hoping, because I know you're such a fan of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, I was hoping you could give me just an elevator pitch, remind everyone what the plot of that movie is.
Oh, it's
without saying it's the plot of The Nice Guys.
It's the plot of Charlie Varick combined with The Nice Guys. small time crook accidentally ends up being hired as a big time movie star, takes detective lessons, and during the detective lessons befalls not one, but two mysterious noir style cases in the hot, sexy Hollywood Hills.
All right. Oh, hot, sexy Hollywood Hills. My least favorite part of literally all of Los Angeles.
And The Nice Guys is a movie that begins in the hot, sexy Hollywood Hills. And then two would-be private eyes become entangled in something way bigger than they bargained for.
Yeah, yeah. There's an element of writing one of these kind of murder mystery, you know, sort of yellow paperback, yellow paperback's giallo, but pulp.
Yeah.
You know, paperback kind of literature.
It's like a Pulp Fiction, but not that kind anymore, sadly.
Yeah,
That's different now.
It's a fiction, comma, pulp.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, just doing things like you have a dead person who's really alive. They're an actor or a movie star or something. You know, sure. This is the plot of a million of these things.
I mean, it's L.A. Confidential, but funny is what we're talking.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it was the reason you see this in movies over and over is because it calls back to pulp literature. Mm-hmm. There, how about that one? Is that all right?
Yeah.
It's going to be one of those fucking shows where I have to just come up with a synonym for Pulp Fiction over and over because we can't use that anymore.
Yeah.
Damn. Yeah, because this was a cheap kind of dime store. Oh man, I'm better at this than I thought.
Yeah.
I'm going to use them all up right now. This was a cheap dime store tactic for just so many of these novels to get made. And as they started getting translated into film, they became a very special type of noir, actually not unlike the story of Giallo. This is much how, my understanding anyways, I'm not going to pretend I read a bunch of like yellow paperback Italian novels or what the fuck ever, but much the same way that Giallo came into film. So you started seeing these in the noir days, and then there started being callbacks to these, especially in the 90s and neo-noir. And I think, you know, The Nice Guys, it just doesn't seem like we had one in a while. You know, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang definitely stood out.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a couple, actually there's been a couple starring Ryan Gosling.
Mm-hmm.
And LA Confidential is another one of my favorite of these.
That's starring the other guy, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm just saying, you know, of...
Yeah.
Shut up. Yeah. Yes, whatever. Point over. I don't want to even make points anymore. I'm done. Never mind. What were you saying?
Well, I was just going to talk about how this is clearly not only something that is a place of affection for Shane Black, but a place of strength.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like in my head, Shane Black goes about his career going, well, these are the movies that I'm trying to make, but every time I get hung up, you know, like when, you know how Rob Zombie's story of 31, where he was like, I was trying to make this other movie about hockey or Groucho or some other normal shit.
Or literally anything else. And everyone was like, what about clowns though?
I was trying really hard.
What about clowns on Halloween?
And I got stuck trying to make this real movie. And then I was talking to my friend and I was like, you know, I could make some fucking killer clowns on Halloween movie, like in my sleep. And I just can't make this hockey movie with Groucho get off the ground.
That's when I stood outside his producer's house shouting, I will give you this money.
Well, that's what everybody did. His friend basically went, well, why don't you just clear the bats out of the attic and make some fucking killer clowns on Halloween movie in your sleep?
Yeah.
And that's what 31 is.
Uh-huh.
And then he went back to like, I guess I'll do this Groucho's the goalie movie. And then that didn't happen either.
This is like the deepest Rob Zombie cuts. No one's going to have any idea what you're talking about.
And I feel like Shane Black goes, well, I was really just trying to, you know, get Predator off the ground again for the 19th year in a row. But
yeah,
I just got hung up and I decided it'd be really funny to make Russell Crowe punch Ryan Gosling for an hour and a half. So
it was so taking the frustrations out. Yeah, well, you know, you feed this thing. I mean, when you work in movies and that's your outlet, I think people get into film because it's therapeutic. And then it has to become commercial. It's like any freelance art form where you're torn between commercial viability and like the stuff you love. That's where Rob Zombie was too.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I have all of these stories to make. I have a Broad Street Bullies thing and I have a Groucho thing. And I mean, we've talked over the years about so many Rob Zombie projects.
Sure.
That, you know, I've had this and that.
Tyrannosaurus Rex had a truck at Comic-Con.
Yeah. Well, there's some other story behind that, but that's for another show. There was some other, that truck was not supposed to be at that Comic-Con. I think that was the story there. I think somebody fucked up on that one. But yeah, you know, so he wants to make all of this other stuff and you get like kind of put in a box. People go, yeah, but how do we know you can do that? We know you can do one of them clown things. Why don't you give us one of those good old clown things? And so many times people look at directors and actors are so true of this too. And they go, oh yeah, that's the guy who does this one thing over and over. When really, I mean, God, as artists, I feel like as I'm thinking of concepts or whatever, I'm always going, that's too close to the last thing. Do some other new direction, some other new. And then, you know, you just get told in meetings over and over like, yeah, but have you done anything exactly like that before? Mm-hmm. How do we know you can do it? Mm-hmm. You know? So people get put in these boxes. Shane Black's history, I didn't really know before The Nice Guys. I'd known the stuff we talked about him directing and Iron Man 3, mm-hmm. obviously, which was very much out of his wheelhouse mm-hmm. of like a pulp. It wasn't like, hey, let me give you a pulp version of Iron Man mm-hmm. 3.
It did, however, feature another actor from LA Confidential. So it's at least on par with that.
You do, yeah, you do sort of see, well, you do, that's the hard part is you do have to kind of have threads tying you to these things somehow.
Yeah.
So that people go, oh, that's a good choice because of this.
Yeah.
No one's going to go, well, yeah, you would be great to bring onto this project or get financing for or whatever, because it's literally the opposite of everything you've ever done or thought about in your professional career. That mm-hmm. doesn't happen very often. But before that stuff, he had written, I mean, he's been writing things since the 80s, which I had no mm-hmm. idea that he started as a writer and that he did all of the,
Predators,
I don't know.
His how, baby.
All the Lethal Weapon movies.
Yeah, Lethal Weapon
say,
too, yeah.
I think it was 1 through 4, but I don't actually know how many Lethal Weapons there are, or if there's a
there
reboot by the time
four.
This comes out. Or
there's a TV yeah, series, but the
I was going to say it. There's a TV series. Yeah. Well, I think he did the TV series, so
probably.
Maybe I'd forgotten that yeah. too. Right. Yeah, and Last Action Hero, which we did.
Last
Didn't
Action
we do that?
House on the Left, yeah.
Yes, I believe we did that. So we've actually covered a fuck ton of the things, maybe all of the things that he's written.
Aside from the fact that Lethal Weapon.
Oh, yeah. Well, we just covered it in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
This is, I don't know if you knew that, but it's Charlie Varick, The Nice Guys, and 2 minutes on all the
Lethal Weapons
where we guess how many Lethal Weapons yeah. there are. Oh, no, Long Kiss Goodnight. I don't think we've ever done that
cool.
on the show. That was actually, that's hella pulpy, too.
Yeah.
That's very, very much pulpy. Yeah.
So this movie, it lands in that really good spot for him, and it translates to this incredibly strong thing. And you just, it's kind of, it's interesting to just watch all the boxes get checked, but it still, for me, lands kind of, it begs the same questions that Charlie Varick does, which is like, these two guys suck. I mean, one is more like, I'll punch you in the face bad, and the other one is like, I'm comfortable being a bad father bad. So like, mm-hmm. you can take your pick on which one's the worst of the two guys, but like, they're not cool dudes. I just, it's amazing to watch the magic of cinema and a talented writer take somebody who is intrinsically unlikable and make you so happy they're on the screen for 90 minutes.
So what do you break that down for me? Because that's maybe the most interesting part, certainly for the purpose of our show today. Let's call it the most
yeah.
interesting part, because that's the theme of the movies. But what is it? Why do we like The Nice Guys so much when that we're told? We're probably told more than I actually even feel that they are bad people.
Sure. I mean, it's a technique that's been going on since the 1920s, man.
Fighting around the world? Is well, that no, the
in a way, but I mean, like, Charlie Chaplin is poor and dirty, but he's fun to watch.
He is a scamp.
Yeah. Even. And the Three Stooges, they're dumb. I mean, it's the name, their name. They're dumb.
Mm-hmm.
And there's how much fucking Three Stooges content in the world, in the planet.
Yeah, right.
There's something about the onset of going, these people suck, watch them suck.
Right.
And then just, you know, like, I mean, it's not, there's not a lot of redemption for these characters. They win, they succeed. And you know, like with minimal loss and maybe just enough redemption to feel like enough redemption for you to feel like maybe there's been a character arc, but not so much redemption that there couldn't be a sequel.
I'm fighting so hard to there's like a Greek mythology muscle in my body that I'm trying to leave shut out of the show, but just know at any time that trap could spring.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to stay a little more fucking current than that. But yeah, I mean, just in
ancient Greece.
I know, right? That's just a thing that happens.
We're operating in the 1970s,
sometimes.
But I think I want to go a little further back to ancient Greece.
I just feel the need to one up Shane Black. He's like, let's go back to the 70s. I'm like,
and I'm like, let's go back to the 20s. And you're like, let's go back to BCE.
You know, an ancient Chinese theater when all these ideas originated. Yeah. I think that, you know, looking at the archetype of something like a, you know, looking at a scamp archetype, it's based around one redemptive method of, you're right. Redemption is not really even the quality. I want to be really specific about it. If we look at the nice guys, there's sort of redeeming qualities, but ultimately no redeeming ends.
Sure.
Because the thing they're doing does not really have effect. And I think that's one of the great part of the story, and that's the Odyssey part that I'm trying to push out.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, were you about to say that the Odyssey is Greek mythology?
No.
Okay,
well,
cool.
I was going to go into the Iliad. Excuse me, but I... See, my body's trying to stop me from doing it. Oh my God, whatever. Leaving it in. Staying current. Stop it. You're poking the hive. I can feel you doing it.
Yeah.
I can feel you go like, oh, which chapter were you? Let me just pull out my
copy here.
Poking
the golden bear. Yeah.
Yeah. Stop poking the... Right. Stop swatting that beaver at the golden bear. Knock it off. There are... So for people who don't really achieve their end goal, you know, there is a father quality that's important. There's this sort of relationship between Gosling's character and his kid and their bond and some baggage they have to get over.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the other thing about conflict is that you don't need to see the character solve the conflict. To go back to what I was talking about with the last movie, it's not about and then they must overcome.
Mm-hmm.
Our favorite movies are movies in which they do not overcome.
Right.
It's movies where they wake up and they're still in the cave.
Mm-hmm.
Or
they just, it turns out they're a bug forever.
Right. Or they're 47 meters more down than they thought they were. You know,
shit.
These type of things.
Yeah.
Sorry, was I dropping spoilers in there? No one will know what movie it's from, so it doesn't matter.
The Shallows.
It's only...
Yeah, no, you're right. And one of the things, too, that is really funny about what you're saying and... in measuring these characters by their successes is that the bulk of this film is these two characters going, at whatever cost, we have to protect this girl. And she gets hella shot to death.
I know. So you see them go through the motion.
Yeah.
You see them fight to, that's to be more specific and to build on what we were thinking about in the previous one. You know, I don't want to sound like an expert in psychology. I really have no expertise in that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just looking at these films and trying to figure out, like, what do they tell us about the way we view our protagonists? And if we're to learn just by the evidence before us, I think the suggestion is that we like watching people fight for their life, and it doesn't actually matter if they, you know, they get the thing they want.
Right.
It, one, doesn't matter. That's what we learned in the last movie. It doesn't fucking matter what the thing is. But also, it doesn't even matter if they get it.
Mm-hmm.
If the money goes up in smoke,
mm-hmm.
if the girl they're trying to protect dies,
mm-hmm.
we just identify with them fighting for it.
Sure.
And it's kind of what makes me like the downer endings.
Sure.
Because that ends up being a place where, you know, you can do something else of that has an interesting quality to it. So many people feel like, well, then we need the good ending because that's what makes the journey worth it. And okay, so now we are officially saying things that have are just fucking cliches. It's the journey, not the destination.
Yeah.
So make your destination fucked up, people. That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, sure. Well, or make it
fuck
really
fuck up your destination, make it interesting to look at.
Either fuck up your destination or just make it comically contrived where you're like, oh, Detroit is trying to bring down the environment. You can't right. bring down Detroit. That just shit like that. I mean, God, this movie, talk about like that's maybe the other piece of this puzzle. Is that this movie has so much personality that the failure doesn't feel like a loss.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's the personality that makes these two characters, it's not just them fighting for the conflict, but I think it is the humor.
Mm-hmm.
It is everybody you'd mentioned before, Three Stooges. I mean, all of it is based on the charisma of
sure.
comedy.
Yeah.
Some charismatic value. I don't think that has to be comedy to make people really charismatic, but The Nice Guys is just so heavy on comedy of a big variety, but actually specifically to what you were talking about, physical comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's Ryan Gosling getting punched and falling over things is like a big component of it, and that makes us root for those characters.
Sure. And then in very standard sort of Shane Black style, the movie is big and it widens as it goes. Kind of that final...
How big does this conspiracy
go? Yeah, right? Exactly. All the way to the tippy top.
Wow.
And it's just... The movie, by the end, when you're at that big convention, it's just mm-hmm. kind of what we're saying this whole time. It's you could sit there and pause the film in that moment and be like, how the fuck did we get here? And why right, are these right. two small-time private eyes trying to find a porno?
Yeah,
like
totally.
Where in this through line does this make sense? And does it make sense, or is it just really, really shoddily stitched together, but we're just having such a good time we don't care? And that's to go back to the sort of paperback novels that we've been referencing, like that's all those ever were. It's just like, we can get you to the end of this book before you start realizing that this is just, I mean, it is a gossamer web of actual plot.
mm-hmm.
If we can get you to the end, you're engaged. It doesn't matter. You know, if all you don't necessarily have to understand the every link on the chain. You just have to agree that the links are connected to the next link. That's all you have to do.
Totally.
And
totally.
And I think the movie knows that to a certain degree. And when it gets to the end of this movie, it's just like, yeah, we took you all the way here. It's kind of like when Black Dynamite, the last act of Black Dynamite, where it's just like, sure. okay, yeah, I guess this started in a really sort of small scale. And now we're in a very different place.
yeah,
and,
totally.
And it's just this joke. I mean, the movie is just this joke at that point where it's just like, these guys should not be here. I mean, there is only one course of events that could ever land them here, and you just happen to see it play out perfectly.
Well, so the thing that I didn't want to make any time to talk about, which, hey, look, it's the end of the show, was fucking Sisyphus,
yeah.
right? I
yeah.
mean, that is...
Right, Scissorface, he's a Cenobite.
By getting to the end of the movie and having them not save the day,
mm-hmm.
and then sit at a bar and kind of go, oh, fuck, we didn't save the day. What did any of this matter? They add this whole dimension that suddenly gives the entire story. Up to that scene, did not have this quality. And that fucking scene gives it the entire quality of Sisyphus.
Mm-hmm.
which is the story about pushing a boulder up the hill.
Mm-hmm.
It's I know, I think we've talked about this off air, so I won't expect the audience to have been all listening when that happened, although I don't know, maybe.
Sure.
Sisyphus is the story of this guy who was condemned to roll this boulder up a hill, and every time the boulder got to the top of the hill, it would roll back mm-hmm. down, and then he would have to go back down there and get it and roll it back up the hill. Mm-hmm. And it was just so fucking pointless, and he had to go through the conflict. It's once again this great story about conflict, because we're watching him do this. We feel bad for this man who is ultimately, I believe, being punished.
Yeah, it's a punishment.
I could have really like primered up on Sisyphus before doing this show, but I didn't.
No, you're fine. It's too late.
But the reason that I know the Sisyphus story so well is because it links into Franz Kafka, which we do talk about all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Franz Kafka, I mean, I don't need to explain that stuff. We talk about it literally constantly. But a more pointed, a less Lynchian version of Franz Kafka, a just more pointed, direct version of that is the story of Sisyphus. And it says a lot of things about how we emote with a person, but also is its own kind of story about existential crisis. It's not about rolling the boulder up the hill because one time it might make it over, although maybe that's what it is for you. But it's just more that you're just going to fucking do it.
Well, and a lot of it is...
There's only one boulder and one hill to this game.
It's like,
so
that's the real thing, is it's like, what the fuck else are you going to do? Not roll the boulder? That's doing less.
But, yeah. right. Right. And it's inherently like funny and tragic. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's a great way to distill these things that are infinitely complicated down to just the basics of watching this man roll this.
Right.
Thing up the hill and seeing, you know, what you can derive. I mean, just in talking about it, we've already derived like an existential crisis, the only game in town, the inherent tragedy of it. And none of that stuff, it would all kind of be lost on the nice guys had they just won in the end.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of the great things about Shane as a writer is I think, you know, after you write so much, maybe it's a confidence thing or I don't know, just to know that, okay, hear me out on this. We don't have to have the happy ending. We don't have to have an ending where they win.
We don't have to have characters we like or characters that are good. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's the difference, right? We just have to like them in a way for this story to work. We need this conflict not to pay off, but to really be, you know, the stakes are so high. Mm-hmm. The obstacle that causes the conflict. It's like I was talking about villains before. It's so fucking big. These guys have to want to get that boulder to the top of the hill, and the fucking foot that kicks it back down has to be the biggest foot known to man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the fact that the story gets bigger and bigger really helps that.
Sure.
And it allows it, I think that's what allows it to cut harder at the end, for it to be such a like, oh, that was totally worthless. Because the story was so, you know, it hits so hard on the way there.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the entire world, all of Detroit, is fighting against these guys by the end. That's what makes that conflict so compelling. They want it so bad. It's everything to them. And the obstacles they come up against are so impossible to overcome. And Shane knows from a writing standpoint that that works, so much so that it doesn't even, by the time you get to, well, like, do they win in the end? He goes, oh, I don't know. I mean, I guess, or no, or no, I guess not. In fact, I think it's smarter than that, because then it can sit there and kind of, it shows that it's meditated on these sort of
right.
Sisyphus-like qualities. Anyways, we got to go. I want to thank some executive producers. That's Athena Banks, Tom Comey, Charles Crawford, Aaron Shore, David Anderson, Jordan Sells, Keisha Benacker, Mark Abbott, and the Abbott of Unreason.
Yeah.
Those are the executive producers of the show. That's patreon.com/double feature.
Uh-huh, heard of it.
Since we started recording, we fell under our goal. I don't know how that happened, but it did. If you want it, that's how fast these things can just just burned to the ground. That's patreon.com/double feature to ensure that we can see two movies next week.
Next week is actually a show that you inspired and I picked. This is the closest to putting the schedule together that we've done so far this year. We're going to do a Frank Hennenlotter movie and we're going to do a Abel Ferrara movie.
Love it.
So we're going to do Basket Case, which is a movie about this basket person. And then, trust me, that's the plot. And then we're going to pair that with Abel Ferrara's The Funeral, which is the most obscure of his big walk-in team-ups. And so I think that's what we're going to do next week. How's that sound? I don't care. Watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the battleship Pretension Fleet.